You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard Lopate on this gray afternoon. In his new collection of short stories and poems called War Dances, Sherman Alexie addresses family illness, adolescent confusion, and Native American politics with his signature serious humor. He is author of more than 20 literary works, and his recent novel, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, won the National Book Award for Young People's Literature. War Dances is published by Grove Press, and I'm delighted that it brings Sherman Alexie to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. It's always great to be here.
In this book, there are so many different glimpses of fathers and sons, and sometimes it's a very strong bond, and sometimes it blows everything apart, and sometimes it does both, which I think is true in many, many parent-child relationships. There's a moment in one story where a man's wife has gone off with her mother, traveling in Europe, and he's home with his two sons alone, and he's just heard some very troubling news, and he talks about how that night his two small sons crawled into bed with him, and it was such a true moment of what family life is like. I know you have kids yourself. Have you found becoming a father has changed the way you write and the way you look at the world?
Well, necessarily it does, but I don't think it's changed in the way most people talk about it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think I'm a little more honest about parenthood, you know, at least more honest about the, you know, lack of magic in birth.
Yes.
I mean, you know, they tell you all these beautiful things about childbirth. It's actually a primal.
Well, maybe they tell men a lot of things, beautiful things about childbirth. Women, they tell.
Are they honest about it? I don't know.
These days, I think.
Okay.
It depends on where you are, but they're pretty honest about it.
Oh, wow. But and then raising a kid is the same way. It's filled with terror and fear and boredom and frustration and love and magic. So,
And also that kids, I mean, in this story, the father, I would guess, doesn't tell the kids, I think I may have a brain tumor, but they get it. They pick it up right away.
Well, I think, certainly my kids are a lot smarter at their ages than I ever was. So I think kids become adult-like far quicker these days than they used to, which is mostly a good thing. But my son certainly, I had a similar health problem, not the same one. My sons quickly picked up on my fears, so.
Did they know, because they had heard you talking about it, or do you think just emotionally they?
Emotionally they picked up on it, and then we had to have the conversation.
Yeah.
As if, well, if I fall down, run over to Mike and Chris's, the neighbors, and get them. So,
wow.
And you know, they were scared, but they dealt with it. And you know, as with anything, I guess, when, you know, we got closer over that, the notion of them being afraid for me.
Right, as opposed to the other way around, which is the way it's, you know, expected to
be.
Yeah,
now there are three males wandering our house in constant fear for each other.
How old were they when all of this happened?
6 and 11.
So they were young. And how big are they now?
They're 12 and 8.
Oh, all right. So they're
12
they're
and
still,
7.
Still young guys.
They're little dudes.
Yeah, yeah. Do you find that writing about that, I hadn't known that you had had the same health scare, but a health scare, that stories come out of your own experience in that way?
Oh, always. You know, everything I write is vaguely autobiographical. But I suppose everything everybody writes is, because it ends up being about your obsessions. In fact, I think nonfiction, a person's choice of nonfiction reveals far more about them than fiction does.
I would think that's absolutely true, because you're always choosing, even in nonfiction, what it is you're about to put down on the paper. And by that choice, you are revealing something about yourself.
Yeah, so I think secrets are more revealed in nonfiction. I'm a reservation-raised Native American, so that is the majority of my characters are reservation-raised Native Americans. Number one, it's my obsession, of course, but number two, it's not like the world is filled with reservation literature. I mean, there's just a handful of us who are actively publishing. It's an untapped market. There's still stories to be told. You know, I'm glad there's much less pressure on me than some, you know, white guy from New York.
To come up with something new.
Yeah,
I mean,
you know, that whole thing. I'd hate to be a white guy in New York. Look who you're competing with.
In addition to stories like the one we were just talking about, where the main character is a father, there are a number of powerful stories where the narrator is a son. And there's one, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's early on in the collection, where there's a son whose father has just had an operation, and he's trying to get him a hospital blanket, which, if any of us have ever spent time in a hospital, you know, is basically, I think you describe it as one step above, I can't remember, but they're just so thin. And
oh, the world's largest coffee filter.
Yes, the world's largest. But this man knows exactly where to go to get a blanket. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Now, this is very autobiographical, actually. I was in the recovery room with my father after he had surgery, and the blankets are terrible, like we were saying. So I kept asking for a better blanket, and they didn't have any. And my mom wasn't there. She was coming. She was on the way. So I couldn't get a good blanket from her, the van. So I knew where to go. So I started just wandering the hospital hallways, the rooms, looking for another Indian. But the thing is, we're when you get vaguely brown in this country now, because it is so cosmopolitan, you can't tell what people are. Mm. So I was guessing, is that guy Asian? Is that guy Chicano? You know, is he Indian? So I saw a guy and I thought he was Indian. So I went up to him and got my res accent on, you know, hey, are you Indian? Yeah. So, and then I asked if they had extra blankets, and his sister was having a baby. So they had bunches of blankets and they gave me one.
In the story, it's not just the blanket that the character gets. It's also a song.
Yes, that wasn't part of the transaction in real life. But one of the things going on in the story is that the man is there with his father and his sister. And the father, this sort of fashioned himself a contemporary shaman and is singing a healing song, a naming song in the hospital for the baby. But then comes out with the blanket and sings a healing song for the blanket. And the narrator is highly suspicious and cynical about this. He's Indian, but he's still, I guess what you say, an agnostic Indian. And he's suspicious of the religious motives of the old Indian guy. But he brings the blanket back to his father, puts it on him, and then his father begins to sing. So the blanket, despite all the suspicions and despite all the differences in religious belief, ends up having power.
I'm speaking with Sherman Alexie. His new series of short stories and poems is called War Dances, and it's from Grove Press. Songs do have a power in this collection, and that's one of them. As a reader, as I read that, I thought the blanket is giving some sort of comfort, but there's also that feeling that comes with it that the father seems to have picked up. Here's a man who's just had both his feet partly amputated, and yet he's singing. It was a remarkable moment.
Yeah, the book is filled with songs and the notion of songs and ancient songs, old songs, not just tribal, but also rock and roll.
Right.
The book itself is something of a mixtape. I sort of based it on that idea of putting together all these different poems, stories, question and answer sequences, mini stories to sort of have that mood of an old-fashioned cassette mixtape. And so the book at various points celebrates the idea of old music, old rock and roll music, even old ways of distributing it, vinyl and cassette. One of my jokes on the road now is that, white America has completely abandoned its musical past. So I've declared that vinyl and cassette are indigenous.
So this is your territory now.
Exactly.
And you'll get to bring it back to us.
You may not take care of them, but I will. You know, me and Chuck Klosterman.
And is music something in your own life that has a real power too?
Well, growing up on a reservation, when I did in the 60s and 70s, we were very culturally isolated. And it isn't like now, when I travel the country talking to young folks, they really don't even know what the term culturally isolated means anymore. So the only thing we really did have was music. Music was the way in which I fell in love with white folks.
Mm, that was your connection to the outside world.
Exactly.
Was it through radio? Is that
radio how? And then, cassettes and albums, and we couldn't always afford new ones. We'd go to Goodwill and you'd, get a record out and you'd pull it out of the sleeve and you'd be examining the vinyl for scratches, wondering, well, that one's with the grain. I think that'll be okay. But that one across the grain looks like the Grand Canyon. That's going to skip. That's going to skip. So, and then listening to it together, that was the big thing. That doesn't happen anymore.
We're as a family or as kids together?
Friends and family. Mm-hmm. The big album, and getting it home and putting it on the stereo and everybody sitting there in a room together to listen to it.
I can remember that from my childhood, too, and that the hi-fi took pride of place in the living room. That was the thing that we all listened, that we all did together. The TV was off somewhere else, but the record player was the thing we gathered around.
Yeah, the community. And we had one of those ones that had an 8-track player in it as well.
Didn't have that.
And then the disco lights.
So it was an audio-visual experience,
yes,
too.
And we still have that. It doesn't work. It hasn't worked in probably 30 years, but it's still sitting in my bedroom. I can't get rid of it.
Oh, wow. Going back to Fathers and Sons, there's one story in here about a father and son that raises some very troubling moral questions, in that it's told from the point of view of the son, who is the son of a kind of on-the-rise Republican senator. And this young man does something horrible that could jeopardize his father's career.
Yes, he ends up gay-bashing who he thinks is a stranger, but ends up being an estranged childhood friend who's lost their, they fell apart, they broke apart when the Indian man of the friendship came out as a gay man.
I've just learned something about this story. I hadn't realized that that man had been an Indian man.
Yes,
too.
The gay man is also an Indian man.
Wow, and they had been best friends.
Yes,
since they were tiny boys.
Yes, and then the revealing of his sexuality is what breaks up the friendship, and so it ends up being a story about forgiveness, fathers and sons, and sort of filtered through a conservative lens. You know, I'm a lefty commie guy, so it was interesting for me to try that. In some ways, I don't think the story fully works, but it was a very interesting way for me to try to get at a different kind of character, which is something I've been interested in lately.
Well, there is a moment of forgiveness in the book from a kind of political standpoint that I read and it took my breath away. And I think that even though it was hard to understand, it also was just quite wonderful to see that happening in the story.
I think there's some beautiful stuff in there, but I am rewriting, actually. We have a whole new concept for this book, and you'll see shortly. But the notion of it's funny, I think it was David Letterman, you had Paul Schaefer on. It was David Letterman's confession that I was going that way for the senator in the rewrite. The notion of actually being very honest about what has happened.
That's interesting, which would change the story dramatically.
Yes, I think I'll retitle it to Fable. Watching a politician grapple with honesty.
How is it for you to put something out? I mean, this is printed and out there, and yet you're still thinking about it. It sounds like it's still deep in your imagination.
Well, one of the things I'm conceiving here is every other artist, every other kind of artist gets to reconceive and reconfigure. Painters do it. They have a series of paintings. Sculptors do it. They have a series.
Musicians get to play a song in concert over and over again.
Over and over and again, reinterpret it, recover it. And why shouldn't writers have to? Why are we the ones locked in place?
That's interesting.
So especially in this culture where nothing is locked in place. Movies used to be locked in place, and those aren't locked
in
place
anymore. And
even
now you have a director's cut that comes out years later.
And you have commentary. So I've decided that I don't have to be locked in place. And I don't think writers should, because we've all talked about this. You know, in private, we talk about this. We talk about the ways in which, you know, with years change of who you are, you think about something, a collection you've written, a novel, a story, an individual poem, and you think about the ways in which your life has changed and the way you might rewrite that and the way you might rethink that. And I thought, why not do it quickly? Why not do it, especially because I'm on tour, so I'm spending months and months
talking about this
book and what it is and what I hope it to be. And I just think, I think the idea of a remix of a story and poem collection is really cool. And I hope it sort of inspires a lot of other people to be open about their artistic process.
It's interesting to think about. I hadn't ever thought about it in that way, that books, we expect once it's written and printed, it's done.
Yeah.
And you're not supposed to. I mean, there are authors, I think, who do go back. I remember we had Joyce Carol Oates on a show that I worked on, and she talked about going back and rewriting something, but it was years later. But you're doing it in a much quicker time frame.
Exactly. And so I think it's also a way to deal with the changing nature of book publishing and book culture. The idea of competing with electronic books and then the technology is the notion of, well, let's keep it a book, but let's advance the notion of what a book can be and what it can mean.
You talked a little bit about music and the essential nature of it, and I was wondering that the title has dances in it. It's war dances. Where does that come from?
Well, war dances, it is a cultural event in the Indian world. Traditionally speaking, war dances were used for Native warriors to get prepared to go into battle or to celebrate a battle or to mourn a battle. So, but it's an oxymoron, if you think about it, war dances is. And so the book itself is a sort of notion of masculinity being a war dance, a constant battle between the more violent and more artistic parts of one's personality. And I think in some sense that's what every character in this book is dealing with, as I deal with as a man and as an artist, the masculine and feminine clashing and the masculine always winning.
It's lovely, though, to think that when you're dancing, it's much harder to actually fight. That's very nice in war dances.
Yes, and when you're laughing, too. So.
Yes, yes. Humor is such an important part of this book as well.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Sherman Alexie about his collection of stories, War Dances. It's published by Grove Press. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.